Good morning. What I would like to do is address this seemingly very simple question. Where is coronal plasma heated? Now, you may be thinking the answer is obvious, especially after hearing Jonathan's very nice talk this morning, but let's remain open-minded and consider all the possibilities. And there are at least three basic scenarios that could potentially answer this question. The first one, shown at the top, let's suppose somehow we get hot plasma in the corona, and then we'll keep it there indefinitely with steady heating in the corona, maintaining that temperature in a static equilibrium type of situation. First possibility. Second possibility, again, the heating is in the corona, but this time, instead of being steady, it's impulsive, you know, a coronal nanoflare, if you will. So when one of those nanoflares goes off, temperature rises. That results in a very intense thermal conduction flux going down the loop legs. That energy enters the chromosphere, heats the chromospheric plasma to coronal temperatures, and it rises up into the loop through the well-known process of chromospheric evaporation. And then if the nanoflare turns off, that plasma, which is now in the loop, it slowly cools and drains back down. The third possibility, here again, the heating is impulsive, but this time it occurs in the chromosphere, not the corona. So you have this sudden heating, it locally raises the temperature and the pressure by tremendous amounts. That high pressure plasma will expand upward into the corona to fill the loop. And again, if there's no coronal heating, that plasma will subsequently cool and drain. Now in this third possibility, that of what I'll call chromospheric nanoflares, there are two sort of sub-possibilities. One is that this nanoflare occurs in association with a type 2 spicule. Many type 2 spicules are observed to be heated at their tips to coronal temperatures as the spicule is ejected. Okay. So this chromospheric nanoflare could be associated with the spicule in this way, or it could be happening completely independent of spicules. And what I'll discuss applies to both possibilities. But it is this third basic scenario that I want to address today. So I want to consider a hypothesis that all of the hot plasma in the corona, in fact, comes from these chromospheric nanoflares. I'll test that hypothesis by predicting some observations and comparing those with actual observations. Now, for making the predictions, I'm going to adopt the approach of 1D hydrodynamics. Now, absolutely, MHD is involved in creating this heating, this localized heating, this chromospheric nanoflare. But once we have this very hot, high-pressure plasma, its subsequent evolution should be fairly well described by 1D hydrodynamics. And I would point out that if, in addition to the heating, there's some kind of an upward kick, as in the case of a type 2 spicule, that kick is both dynamically and energetically unimportant, this is straightforward to show, compared to the evolution due to this high-pressure plasma expanding. So the 1D approach, I think, is very reasonable. Okay, the observations that I want to use to test this idea are spectroscopic observations, observations of EUV line profiles, such as, for example, the well-known iron 14 line at 274 angstroms. Adrian showed this line yesterday. Under equilibrium conditions, it's formed at about 2 million degrees. Now, spectroscopic observations, including those of iron 14, tend to have fairly modest spatial resolution, a couple of arc seconds or so, although hopefully that'll be changing in the future. But for now, that's what we have. In addition, they have rather poor temporal resolution. You know, to beat down the noise, typically the integration times are tens of seconds. So as a consequence, a given observation, you know, a given line profile, actually represents a composite of many unresolved events. So we can approximate this with a single event as long as we average in time over the full duration of the event, you know, the complete heating and cooling phase, the complete upflow and downflow. So that's what I'll be doing to create my synthetic line profiles. All right, so what do we expect? Well, this chromospheric nanoflare goes off, intense heating, there's a rapid expansion. That expansion should give rise to blue-shifted emission out in the line wing. This is a very nice figure from one of Bart's papers. So here's the rapid upflow, emission in the blue wing of the profile. Then later on, that plasma cools and slowly drains back down. That produces the emission in the line core with a small redshift. And so what we see is a composite profile. It's essentially a Gaussian with an enhancement in the blue wing. Okay, many people recently have been looking for such profiles and have found them. I've been involved in a couple of these studies myself. And typically the results are presented in what's called the red-blue asymmetry, which is essentially the ratio of the excess intensity in the blue wing divided by the intensity in the line core. And people have observed asymmetries, measured asymmetries, of something less than 5%. In places, the asymmetry can be larger, in particular in the so-called faint upflow regions at the periphery of active regions. But throughout most of the sun, and certainly throughout most of the active region, these asymmetries are just a couple percent or so. So is this what we expect, this small number here, and as indicated in this cartoon? Well, here, obviously, the upflow is faint compared to the slow downflow. Do we expect that? Well, on the one hand, the upflow is very short-lived compared to the downflow. So in the time average, that would mean the upflow would be relatively faint. On the other hand, the instantaneous brightness of that upflow is much, much, much larger. So there are two competing effects. Which one actually wins out? So we can look at that carefully, and it's possible to derive the following expression here for the ratio between the blue wing intensity to the core intensity. And the result indicates that this ratio is greater than or equal to, so this is a lower limit, this business here. So what does this involve? Well, this is the coronal density, coronal scale height, an expansion factor accounting for the expansion of the flux tube from the chromosphere up into the corona. L is the length of this heated plasma before it starts to expand, the length along the magnetic field, or the vertical extent, if you will. V is the velocity of that expansion. And we can plug in here observed values, and we get these results. We predict, under the assumption that all coronal plasma comes from chromospheric nanoflares, under that assumption, we predict ratios of greater than 3 in active regions and greater than about 1 or so in both the quiet sun and coronal holes. In comparison, as I've already discussed, the observed ratios are less than 0.05. So there is a huge discrepancy here. And clearly, our a priori hypothesis must be incorrect. In fact, only a small fraction of the observed hot coronal plasma is due to these chromospheric nanoflares. And you can work out filling factors that are something like this, you know, of order a percent or so. Okay, so that's an analytical model. In fact, I have quite a bit of confidence in it. It's very simplistic, but it has all the essential physics, so I believe in it. But still, we want to look at things more rigorously if we can. And so Steve Bradshaw and I have been doing that. We've been doing simulations with his 1D hydro code called HydRAD. It's a very powerful code. And we look at a loop, initially in an equilibrium with a low level of background heating, a peak temperature of less than 1,000,000 degrees. We impulsively heat the upper 1,000 kilometers of the chromosphere with one of these chromospheric nanoflares that last 10 seconds. And we let the loop evolve for 5,000 seconds, which is enough time for all of the expansion and the cooling and the draining. It's a full upflow downflow cycle. And we integrate over space and time to get our line profile. And we argue that this then is a good approximation to a line of sight through an arcade of loops. So here's one of our line profiles. It's that iron 14 profile again. What do we notice? Well, first of all, there is far more blue shifted emission, you know, to the left of zero, than there is red shifted emission. The ratio here is about 15. If we were to analyze this profile with the standard techniques that are used to get these red-blue asymmetries, and that involves assuming that the center of the line is at the peak intensity, we would find that the red-blue asymmetry would be about 0.75, very much consistent with what the analytical model predicted. So the analytical results are completely confirmed. And the predicted ratios are far, far greater than the actual observed ratios. Okay, so as I say, all of this refers to chromospheric nanoflares, be they associated with type 2 spicules or not. Let me take a few moments to talk about specifically the type 2 spicule scenario, where the tip of the spicule is heated to 2,000,000 degrees, roughly, as it's ejected, and that heated material then evolves. Well, we'll make the same hypothesis as before, that all of the corona is explained by this hot spicule material, and then see if that's consistent with observations. Well, as I've already discussed, the blue wing to line core intensity ratio predicted by this scenario is about a factor of 100 too big. It's also straightforward to show that the ratio of the emission measure in the corona to the emission measure in the lower transition region, and I take that to be plasma cooler than about 100,000 degrees, that predicted ratio is, again, about a factor of 100, too big, compared to observations. In addition, some recent work with Spiros Patsourakis and Peter Young, We looked at the ratio of the density of the upflowing material revealed in the bluing emission to the density of the draining material in the line core, and we find that the predicted density ratio is once again a factor of 100 too big. So a lot of consistency here. All of these indicate filling factors of about 1%. But it's bad news for people who would like to believe that spicules explain most of the corona. But there is very good news concerning these spicules. I'd like to suggest that type 2 spicules explain most of the bright emission we observe in the lower transition region. That emission, observed emission, is far, far brighter than what standard coronal heating models can predict. Now, these type 2 spicules, as I've said, they're heated as they're ejected, the tip heated to coronal temperatures, but most of the spicule is heated only up to of order 100,000 degrees. And you can then see the spicules in helium 2, and you watch that material then falling back down to the surface. But it's that heated material, which is very bright, and I think explains the excess emission we see at the lower temperatures. So very quickly, here are some typical emission measure distributions. Standard coronal heating models can predict this very well, but they do not predict this very steep upturn. There's way more material, way more bright emission at these temperatures than the standard models can predict. I think the spicules do that. So finally, I'm left with this idea about what the corona is. The corona is made up of many unresolved strands. Most of the strands, you know, 99% or so, are populated with plasma due to coronal nanoflares. 1%, however, are populated with plasma by type 2 spicules or chromospheric nanoflares. So what does that predict in terms of line profiles and emission measure distributions? Well, let's first of all take the coronal heating strands. Here's a typical predicted line profile. And if you were thinking back on the comment I made after Adrian's talk yesterday, if you look at very, very hot spectral lines, the nanoflare model predicts you should get blue shifted emission. But for most lines, it predicts you will not get much excess emission. So sort of a standard profile, maybe slightly red shifted. This is the emission measure distribution that you would get. This part is gray, but there's no upturn here, as observed. Now for the strands that are populated by type 2 spicules, here's the line profile. Most of the emission is blue shifted. Here, I speculate, is the emission measure distribution due to that material, the majority of it that only gets heated partially. So you put these together, giving a factor of 100 weighting to the coronal strands. You get this composite line profile, slightly redshifted with a blue wing enhancement, exactly what we observe. The emission measure distribution, again, exactly what we observe with this upturn. So I'll just conclude very quickly by saying again that chromospheric nanoflares, including those associated with type 2 spicules, provide only a very small fraction of the hot plasma observed in the corona. Most coronal plasma comes from chromospheric evaporation associated with coronal heating. Spicules, however, I believe contribute substantially to the bright emission from the lower transition region, where the standard coronal heating models fail. And finally, we need to better understand spicules. That will involve both theory and observation, you know, detailed MHD modeling. So if you review my proposal, please give it a high mark. And better observations. We're all very excited because IRIS seems to be going well. You know, we don't have first light yet, but everything is on track. Hopefully, we'll have a solar sea with a fabulous spectrometer. And lastly, I'd like to put in a plug for a LASSO rocket experiment of Phil Chamberlain's that would be dedicated to studying spicules. Thanks.
In response to where is coronal plasma heated, we've observed with ice coronal holes, and we're finding evidence of propagating waves at low heights measured from sun center, about 1.05 to 1.15, that have sufficient energy to heat the corona. And also, we see damping between 1.15 and 1.45. 85% of the energy is lost from these waves at sufficiently low heights so that this energy can thermalize throughout the corona. So in response to your question, where's the heating happening, we'd say between 1.15 and 1.45 R sun in coronal holes. Okay.
Very good, and I would point out that my definition of nanoflares is very generic. It's simply an impulsive energy release on a sub-resolution scale. Whatever the mechanism, including wave heating, if you consider wave dissipation mechanisms, most of them, in fact, give rise to nanoflare-like heating.
Poster number 13.
Thanks, Daniel.
So I wanted to question you about two of the parameters in your toy model, which strike me as being negotiable with maybe a couple of orders of magnitude. One is L, and one is delta T. So could you justify the numbers you put in there?
Right. So L, what was the second one? Delta T, temperature?
Yeah, that time scale.
Okay. Absolutely. Well, the L, that comes from observations. If you look at the papers published on type 2 spicules at the LIM, they show that the total spicule length is of order 10,000 kilometers, and it's typically about the top 10%, which is visible in the hot emission. So that comes from observations. But you're right, that's negotiable. The time scale, I guess what I'd like to do is comment that the rigorous models with Steve, we've looked at nanoflares of different durations and loops of different length, and we get the same result that the profile is. Those nanoflares, we've looked at 10 seconds, so far 10 seconds and 100 seconds, I believe. But we can look at shorter durations, too. But going to the basis for the analytical model, the time scale really is not important until you get to huge, long time scales. But